Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the New York Public Library. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers. I want to thank, once again, Betsy Bradley, who has done an incredibly wonderful job of... She's the deputy director of the Coleman Center and the manager of public programs, and she's really pulled everything together to make these evenings work as well as they are working. Most of you have been here before to the other two lectures, so, and you've heard about the other programs we have coming up this spring, so I'll be brief. You'll find flyers like this one and at the table by the exit as you leave, so you can pick them up and find out more in detail if you like to, and also there's a sign-up sheet so that you can get email notices from us in the future about our programs. The headlines are that on April 7th, we're going to have a panel of terrific writers looking from diverse perspectives at the terrorist attacks that took place in Mumbai last fall. Two of those are current Coleman Center fellows. On April 30th, the historian T.J. Stiles will talk about his new book on Cornelius Vanderbilt with the novelist Kevin Baker. I said last week that the fabulous new Ben Ketcher, Mark Mulcahy musical theater piece is sold out. In response to popular demand, we're adding a second night. So the details are still being worked out, but if you're on our email list, you'll get notice about that, and it'll really be fun. Frances Fitzgerald's lecture tonight will be the last in her superb series on the general topic, Politics in the Church, the Changing Face of American Evangelicalism. This one is called The New Evangelicals. I had an email exchange yesterday with an American historian who has been to the previous two and wouldn't be able to come tonight, and he said he was very sorry he was going to have to miss learning about the Fourth Great Awakening. As we have from every one of these lectures, we're all going to learn a great deal tonight on a hugely important range of topics, and you'll be able to read more of Frances Fitzgerald on these topics, American Evangelicalism, in a book she's working on, which is how she's so immersed in this terrific and terrifically important subject, and we're hoping that will be within the next year or two, published by Simon & Schuster and her editors in the audience tonight. Ms. Fitzgerald will speak for about 45 or 50 minutes and then take a few questions at the end, so I now turn the evening over to her. Thank you very much for doing these three wonderful lectures.
Thank you very much, Jean, and thank you all for coming. This lecture is going to be rather different from the others. It's journalism. It's up to date. I did a lot of history before and some analysis, but this is up to the minute. News from the evangelical front. If you watched the inauguration, and who didn't, you may remember the big man with flying red hair who gave the invocation. That was Rick Warren, the author of The Purpose-Driven Life, the pastor of a megachurch in Southern California, and the best-known evangelical pastor in the country. If you watched him closely, it's probably because you heard something of the furor that erupted when he, an opponent of abortion and gay marriage, was chosen to give the invocation. As you doubtless remember, a host of liberal Obama supporters charged the president-elect with selling out the gay community and women's rights. The furor went on for weeks in the blogosphere, and in the midst of it, a few liberal commentators, such as Rick Hertzberg of The New Yorker, wrote that Obama had made an astute political choice. Yet very few people in the secular press looked at the picture the other way around. What about Warren's choice to be on the platform with a liberal Democrat? And what of the reaction from the religious right and from the evangelical community generally? So let's consider that for a moment. Consider that for the past 30 years, religious right leaders have been condemning the Democrats for their stance on abortion and gay rights and urging evangelicals to vote for the pro-moral party. Their leaders, from Jerry Falwell to James Dobson, have claimed credit for moving evangelicals, a quarter of the voting population, into the Republican camp. In 2004, and doesn't that seem an eon ago? 78% of evangelicals voted for George Bush and provided him with a third of his votes. Claiming to represent all evangelicals, religious right leaders gained extraordinary influence within the Republican Party. As you know, President Bush virtually allowed them to vet his choice of Supreme Court justices, and John McCain clearly considered their wishes in his choice of a running mate. Now that's power for you. So imagine what religious right leaders must have felt seeing the evangelical superstar, Rick Warren, giving the invocation for Barack Obama. Just standing there, Warren was sending a message. We evangelicals aren't a political party, we're Americans, and we won't be bossed around by the religious right. Well, today I'm going to be talking about the growing number of evangelical leaders who have broken with the religious right. Some have directly criticized the right, others have simply set a new policy agenda for evangelicals, one founded in their understanding of the life of Jesus and his mission to the poor and the outcast. This movement has no single charismatic leader, no institutional center, and no set of agreed-upon goals. It hasn't even a name. The New Evangelicals is the best we journalists can do. But it's nonetheless significant because it includes a number of very influential people, and because it's been posing the first major challenge to the religious right in a quarter of a century from within the evangelical community. Rick Warren's a part of this movement. He doesn't lead it or represent it. No one does. But I'm going to begin with him because he's an outsized figure, a man with the energy of about six other people. And he's made a sort of very interesting transition in the past few years. A fourth-generation Southern Baptist pastor, Warren started his own church in 1980 by knocking on doors in suburban Orange County. He has since gathered one of the largest congregations in the country, about 22,000 people. And he's established a network of over 100,000 pastors who look to him for advice on how to lead their churches. The Purpose-Driven Life, which he published in 2002, has reportedly sold more hardback copies in this country than any other book except for the Bible. Alice Mayhew, are you listening? In October 2004, Warren sent his network of pastors an email letter saying that that the election that November would be the most important in half a century. Places on the Supreme Court were coming open, and the presidential candidates held opposite views about the type of people who should fill the vacancies. Christians, he wrote, should vote on the basis of what the candidates believed on five issues that were non-negotiable for Christians: abortion, homosexual marriage, stem cell harvesting, euthanasia, and human cloning. The letter was a barely disguised call to re-elect Bush, and many thought that Warren was looking to play a role in Washington. Yet a few months later, Warren sent the same network of pastors another letter urging them to put pressure on Bush to increase foreign aid, provide debt relief, and reform trade rules to help the global poor. In April 2005, he called upon his congregation to support an effort in Rwanda to alleviate hunger, teach literacy, and slow the spread of AIDS. Warren doesn't think small, so just a few months after that, he announced what he calls his peace plan, an effort to turn the 10 million Christian churches in the world into providers of basic health care, literacy, and economic development. Warren, it seemed, had gone through a form of conversion. I've been so busy building my church that I have not cared about the poor, he told pastors in Kigali. I have sinned, and I am sorry. At an International Baptist convention that summer, he said that the church should be known for what it was for, not for what it was against. A clear slap at the religious right and at his own 2004 letter. Recently, Warren told a reporter that his epiphany had come in 2003. His wife, Kay, who had successfully battled cancer, had dedicated herself to the fight against AIDS. And on a trip with her to Africa that year, it happened, he said. God told me, you don't care a squat about the sick and the poor, and you have to change. You have to repent. It's part of Warren's charm that God talks to him in this fashion. Whenever the epiphany came, Warren has, since 2005, given much of his enormous energy to the peace plan. What will come of his efforts is not yet clear, but simply by espousing such ideas, he influences many American evangelicals to rethink their priorities. In this past election, Warren was much criticized by liberals for supporting Proposition 8, banning gay marriage in California. But it should be noted that he did not campaign for it, but simply posted his position on his church website. Then in a recent interview, he came out for domestic partnership arrangements. Further, he's been consistently bipartisan. In 2006, he invited the famous new senator, Barack Obama, to speak at his annual AIDS conference, and the following year he invited Hillary Clinton, each paired with a Republican senator. Last August, he brought both John McCain and Barack Obama to a civic forum to talk about campaign issues. For all of this and more, Warren has been roundly attacked by right-wing evangelicals. He himself has never attacked the religious right leaders directly, but that summer he told a reporter, "For probably the last 25 years, evangelicalism became co-opted, and for the most part, it became a political term, and it got identified with a particular style of political leaning." Before that spring of 2005, there were essentially only three important evangelical leaders who publicly challenged the agenda of the religious right. Reverend Jim Wallace, the president of Sojourners, a Washington advocacy group for peace and social justice. Reverend Tony Campolo, a sociologist and a fiery Baptist preacher with a ministry to the urban poor. And Reverend Ron Sider, a theologian and the president of Evangelicals for Social Action. All three had founded their organizations in the 1970s, but as energetic and articulate as they were, they made little headway against the right in all those years, and their constituencies seemed permanently confined to a progressive minority. But in the spring of 2005, when Warren announced his peace plan, there was a sudden eruption of progressive activity. The previous fall, the board of the National Association of Evangelicals, an umbrella group of denominations and churches that claims 30 million members, issued a position paper laying out 10 principles for Christian political engagement. The document was presented to a general meeting of the membership in March 2005. The document, for the health of the nation, called upon evangelicals to seek justice for the poor, to protect human rights, to seek peace, and to protect God's creation, as well as to protect the sanctity of human life and to protect families. Those liberal or mainline Protestants who read it thought it a pretty tame piece of work, a statement far behind its time. But for the NAE, it was a major breakthrough. A parenthesis for those of you who came to the last lecture. The National Association of Evangelicals was founded in 1942 as an alternative to the Federal Council of Churches, which represented mainline Protestants, and to the fundamentalist American Council of Christian Churches, founded in 1941 by Carl McIntyre. Theologically, its founders were fundamentalists. They just weren't militant separatists like McIntyre, and they called themselves evangelicals to distinguish themselves from the separatists. And that really is the start of the modern use of the word evangelical right there in 1942. A few years later, the NAE found a champion in the young evangelist Billy Graham, who's then also a fundamentalist. The NAE grew and evolved, and its current leaders are not, by the way, fundamentalists, but it remained a conservative organization devoted mainly to the moral issues and to the defense of church prerogatives. So the new document was a breakthrough. Though carefully worded to prevent a conservative reaction, it permitted NAE progressives, notably Richard Cizik, the vice president for governmental affairs, to move ahead with a new policy agenda. In the spring of 2005, Washington journalists began to notice that evangelical leaders were moving beyond their traditional concerns into a wider sphere of action: global poverty, human rights, the environment, and foreign policy. Furthermore, they were approaching these issues in uncharacteristic ways. As the Congressional Quarterly reported in the fall, two of the largest evangelical aid agencies, World Relief and World Vision, were, after years of charitable work overseas, examining the root causes of poverty. They were lobbying for a major increase in U.S. aid for development, debt relief for the poorest countries, cuts in U.S. agricultural subsidies, and the inclusion of labor standards and human rights conditions in trade agreements. In addition, they and other evangelical groups were calling for an enhanced effort to combat the worldwide AIDS epidemic. Human rights groups, once concerned mainly with sex trafficking and the persecution of Christians abroad, were now working on a variety of causes, including freedom of religion for non-Christian minorities and the deployment of a strong UN peacekeeping force to Darfur. In addition, evangelicals were calling for government regulation to preserve the environment. That fall, a group of scientists and ethicists led by Calvin DeWitt successfully lobbied Congress against Republican-led efforts to water down the Endangered Species Act. Others were organizing evangelical leaders to sign a statement on the need to take action against global warming. Richard Cizik was instrumental in many of these efforts, but not all of them, for many of these groups were not NAE affiliates, and nor, by the way, is Rick Warren's church. The movement that came to life that spring extended well beyond the NAE orbit. In May, 800 students, faculty members, and alumni of Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, published an open letter to President Bush in which they wrote, "Your deeds, Mr. President, neglecting the needy to coddle the rich, desecrating the environment, and misleading the country into war, do not exemplify the faith we live by." Bush's political advisor, Karl Rove, who thought the president needed to visit Michigan, had just 2 months earlier asked that Bush be invited to make the commencement speech at Calvin. Rove presumably thought that this small evangelical college would give Bush a warm welcome. But the open letter to Bush was followed by another one from a third of the Calvin College faculty, accusing the Bush administration of having launched an unjust and unjustified war in Iraq, having taken actions to favor the wealthy and burden the poor, fostered intolerance and divisiveness, and harmed creation. In the event, Bush made half an hour speech and left. Well, what caused this sudden eruption? In the summer of 2005, Mark Knoll, who's a prominent evangelical historian, told the journalist that the NAE document for the health of a nation was, quote, "an effort to bring out of the background things that have always been there but have been overshadowed by the concentration on life issues." He added, "Evangelicals don't want themselves identified as the Republican Party at prayer." As he suggested, some evangelical leaders had wanted to take new directions for years. By 2005, they were further motivated by their embarrassment at the association of all evangelicals with the Bush administration. In the next 2 years, the number of evangelicals who took up on such things, such themes, multiplied and came to include some of the most influential evangelicals in the country: megachurch pastors, the heads of major aid agencies, presidents of evangelical seminaries, colleges, and universities, book and magazine publishers, plus a host of professors and journalists. Some launched direct attacks on the religious right, denouncing its equation of morality with sexual morality, its aggressive intolerance, its confusion of church and state, and its unholy quest for political power. Some of them simply preached the new gospel of service and changed the direction of their institutions. Bill Hybels, for example, the pastor of a church as large as Warren's in Great Barrington, Illinois, and the leader of an association of 12,000 churches, quietly put his congregation to work on racial reconciliation in the Chicago area, the global AIDS epidemic, and poverty in Africa. Other leaders signed well-publicized open letters on issues such as Darfur, a two-state solution to peace in the Middle East, and a comprehensive humanitarian reform of the country's immigration laws. Others directly or indirectly attacked Bush administration policies. In February 2006, 86 evangelical leaders, including 39 evangelical college presidents and several megachurch preachers, Rick Warren among them, signed a statement expressing alarm about man-made global warming and calling for mandatory curbs on carbon emissions. Millions of people could die in this century because of climate change. Most of them are our poorest global neighbors, they wrote. In addition, the NAE board condemned Bush administration policies that permitted torture and the indefinite detainment of prisoners without trial. There were even stirrings within the Southern Baptist Convention, a denomination that since 1980 had been led by conservatives closely aligned with the Republican right. In the 2006 election for the SBC presidency, dissident pastors persuaded their fellows via blogs to reject the establishment candidate. They elected instead Frank Page, a mild-mannered South Carolina pastor who encouraged the moderates and steered clear of partisan politics. His successor has followed suit, but the conservatives still run the denomination's seminaries and agencies. Oops. See if I can read this still. Jimmy Carter, who quit the SBC a few years ago, has done his part for the new movement by creating an organization called the New Baptist Covenant. At its first convention in February 2007, 15,000 Baptists, black and white, gathered from all over the country to discuss issues such as racism, poverty, global warming, peacemaking, and the separation of church and state. Some of the white Baptists were Northerners. Some were Southerners who quit the SBC in protest in the 1990s. But others were active SBC members from the less conservative churches and state conventions, such as those of Texas and Virginia. The organization now holds annual meetings. David Neff, who's editor-in-chief of a major publishing enterprise, Christianity Today International, has been one of the pivotal figures in the new movement. He wrote the first draft of For the Health of a Nation. He's changed Christianity Today from a solidly conservative magazine into a progressive one that's taken the lead on a discussion of subjects as sensitive as divorce and on issues like global warming. He's also been one of those evangelicals who have criticized the religious right directly. George W. Bush is not the Lord, read a Christianity Today editorial of July 2005. The American flag is not the cross. God Bless America is not the doxology. Sometimes one needs to state the obvious, especially at times when it seems less and less obvious. By then, contributors to Christianity Today had come to believe that the religious right had so redefined the word evangelical in the public mind and created such hostility towards evangelicals that the word evangelical might have to be abandoned and replaced by something else, like Jesus followers. Instead, a group of intellectuals, David Neff among them, wrote an evangelical manifesto, a 20-page document affirming what it means to be an evangelical. The document, signed now by hundreds of people, could stand as a manifesto for the new movement, except that much of it is phrased in the negative, the style, I think, of its main author, Oz Guinness. In effect, the manifesto says, "We evangelicals are not theological liberals, but we're not fundamentalist either. And we reject the extreme individualism, the materialism, and the anti-intellectualism that has crept into the church." We don't want a privatized faith that fails to reach out as Jesus did to the poor and the oppressed, but we don't want a politicized faith either because, quote, that way the church becomes the regime at prayer. Christians become useful idiots for one party or another, and the Christian faith becomes an ideology. It's a fascinating document, and it's still online collecting signatures. A better effort to define the movement was made by David Gushee, whom I quoted last week, a professor of Christian ethics at the School of Theology at Mercer University, the founder of a group called Evangelicals for Human Rights, and the drafter of the NAE Statement Against Torture. In a recent book called The Future of Faith in American Politics, Gushee notes that the movement's leaders are theological conservatives who share the concerns of the religious right about abortion, sex outside of a heterosexual marriage, and the preservation of the family. But they have what Gushee calls a consistent pro-life agenda. As he spells this out, the agenda appears to me to accord with Catholic social teachings on war, poverty, and human rights. Though, as he reports, there's no agreement in this group on the death penalty. Then, as his book makes clear, the new evangelical leaders lack the cultural attitudes that descend from the fundamentalist resistance to modernist thought, such as distrust of science, a rejection of institutional solutions to poverty, and the notion that evangelicals are the saving remnant of Christianity and the American tradition. Religious right leaders have perpetuated these attitudes and done their best to see that evangelicals continue to regard themselves as an embattled subculture. The new leaders, however, embrace pluralism. Unlike the right, they don't engage in partisan politics, though many of the policies they espouse coincide with those of the Democratic Party. The movement is new, but it has a potential constituency. Over the years, polls have shown that evangelicals are more conservative than the population as a whole on economic as well as social issues, on foreign and defense policy as well. Yet in a 2004 survey from the Pew Forum that distinguished traditionalist evangelicals, defined as committed churchgoers with more or less fundamentalist religious beliefs, from their less observant and less theologically conservative brethren, these polls revealed significant ideological differences between the two groups. The traditionalists, who made up a half of the evangelical population and represented the core constituency of the religious right, had conservative views across the board on all issues. The other 50%, on the other hand, proved no more conservative than the population as a whole, except on abortion and gay rights. And even there, they were less conservative than the traditionalists. What the survey showed was that the extreme conservatism of the traditionalists had skewed the picture of the evangelical community as a whole, and continues to do so if you look at surveys that don't make these distinctions. Then two polls taken over the decades have shown that each successive generation of evangelicals has been less conservative than the last, theologically, but also on issues such as the role of women and gay rights. This doubtless has something to do with the fact that in recent decades, evangelicals have made greater gains in income and education than any other white religious group in America, in part because they had further to go. Mark Pinsky, a veteran religion writer who has reported for the LA Times, the Orlando Sentinel, and other newspapers, has properly observed that Sunbelt evangelicalism is very different from that of the old Bible Belt. Suburban families trying to get their kids into college don't believe that the earth is only a few thousand years old, and they don't join crusades to post the Ten Commandments in courthouses. Further, they don't like the angry intolerance of the religious right and cringe when they're associated with it. A couple of years ago, I was chatting with Richard Cizik at the back of a meeting, and I asked him why evangelicals were now parting company with the religious right. And he answered very succinctly, changes in the culture, a generational change, and leadership. Well, wanting to see how leadership worked, I spent some time last spring with Dr. Joel Hunter, the pastor of a megachurch in Orlando, Florida, who preaches to 10,000 people in his church and over the internet every Sunday. I had first met Hunter at the press conference announcing the Evangelical Climate Initiative in February of 2006, and since then he had become one of the most active leaders in the new evangelical movement. Perhaps you've heard of Hunter because he gave the benediction after Obama's acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention last summer. He's now a member of the Advisory Council of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. And as the Times reported the Sunday before last, he's one of the five pastors that President Obama prays with. Well, that's something for a registered Republican with a white church in the suburbs of Orlando. But Dr. Hunter is not a new convert to the goals of the movement. He's had to bring his congregation along with him. Originally from Indiana and a minister in the United Methodist Church, but always an evangelical, he moved to Orlando in 1985 and took over a non-denominational congregation of 200 people that hadn't even a church building. 10 years later, he was preaching seven services a week to accommodate 5,000 people in a renovated roller skating rink. Hunter has never been much for the amenities. His church, called Northland, was made up of people who are used to hearing the evangelical message of individual salvation and mutual assistance. But in the mid-1990s, when he felt his congregation was ready, he changed the emphasis of his preaching to the need to serve the community as a whole. "He pushed us out," a member of his congregation told me, and that was the right thing to do. Since then, his parishioners have become active in a wide variety of social service organizations outside the church and in causes from AIDS to low-cost housing in Orlando. Hunter himself established close relationships with other religious leaders in the area with similar concerns, Catholics, Jews, and Muslims. Since 9/11, he and a Muslim imam, who is the head of the Islamic Association of Central Florida, have been working to create some understanding between their two communities. In 1988, when Pat Robertson was running for president, Hunter published a book arguing that the evangelical right had confused the power of the cross with the power of government and failed to grasp the pluralist nature of American democracy. I think the book sold 11 copies, his son told me. Well, it's been republished and revised, of course, and it's selling a great deal more copies these days. Since February 2006, Hunter has, among other things, lobbied Congress for legislation to curb global warming, pressed for comprehensive immigration reform, and denounced the virulent anti-immigrant rhetoric that went on during the Republican primaries. After attending a U.S. Islamic forum in Qatar, where he discovered that even the American diplomats there thought all evangelicals believed that Israel had a biblical right to the Palestinian territories, he gathered signatures for an open letter to Bush, calling for a two-state solution and justice for both the Israelis and the Palestinians. Since 2007, he's worked with a group of evangelicals and secular progressives called the Third Way, to try and establish common ground on the most polarizing issues, such as abortion and gay rights. Hunter's ambition is nothing less than to end the culture wars in the United States. I think the way we've been dealing with differences in this country simply doesn't work, he said. I asked Hunter why he thought the religious right had retained such a hold over evangelicals for 25 years. And Hunter began by evoking the sort of sense of alarm that evangelicals had felt during the cultural upheavals of the 60s and 70s. And he said, "When you're afraid or angry, the loudest voices carry the day." speaking of the Jerry Falwells and Pat Robertsons, he said, you know, I think they showed some courage and some leadership in getting us into the public square. Hunter had told me that he'd been involved in civil rights demonstrations in college, so he went on, but it's like the 60s. Guys like Eldridge Cleaver and H. Rapp Brown. When I heard those guys talk, I thought, that makes me mad, too. I can't believe this could be happening to our country. But the more you listen, the more you go, wait a minute. I see where you're coming from, and that has some legitimacy, but I'm not going to give my life to that. It's part of Hunter's charm that he makes such connections between the Falwells and the Eldridge Cleavers. Also, Hunter said, religious right leaders were intimidating. Radio and television evangelists, they built powerful organizations, and they held the microphone. Who in the world was going to stand up to Jim Dobson, he asked. The pastors all knew how many people listened to Dobson and Falwell and how many people received voting guides from the Christian Coalition. And those who were building their churches couldn't afford to introduce any kind of controversy. You have to come to a certain stature even to be on a playing field with Dobson or Robertson, he said. In Hunter's view, it took not only a change in evangelical attitudes, but also the emergence of a new generation of leaders with power bases of their own to challenge the right. Hunter and others have often come under attack from what Richard Cizik calls the enforcers of the religious right. Until recently, the movement's stance on global warming was one that provoked the most fury from the right. Even before the Evangelical Climate Initiative statement was released, James Dobson and Richard Land, who's the official in charge of public policy for the Southern Baptist Convention, along with others, wrote to the NAE saying that global warming was not a consensus issue. They raised enough opposition on the board to prevent Cizik, its strongest promoter, from signing it. The Interfaith Stewardship Alliance, a group supported by Dobson and other prominent right wingers, argued that man-made global warming was an unproven theory and that policies designed to combat it would slow economic development and hurt the world's poor. Well, in fact, global warming involves the kind of science that right-wing or fundamentalist evangelicals have always distrusted. Theories, abstractions, as opposed to sort of common sense reasoning. Further, all remedies for it seem to involve government intervention of the sort that goes contrary to the laissez-faire economics of the religious right. Even Hunter's congregation is divided over global warming. The church thus stresses environmentalism, or what they call creation care, and works on recycling and energy efficiency, and Hunter is simply bringing people along slowly. Yet, as James Dobson and Tony Perkins, the president of the Family Research Council, and others made clear, the most serious objection the religious right leaders had to a campaign against global warming was that it would distract evangelicals from their mission to oppose abortion and support family values. In other words, as one put it quite frankly, it might divide evangelicals and weaken the right. A showdown came at the NAE meeting in March 2007. Days earlier, Dobson and 24 other right-wingers, none of them NAE members, wrote an open letter stating that Cizik had put forth his own political opinions as scientific fact and had used global warming to, quote, shift the emphasis away from the great moral issues of our time. They called for Cizik's resignation. This time, however, the board supported Cizik and Hunter defended him publicly. The conflict then moved to the Southern Baptist Convention. In June, the SBC passed an official resolution that questioned whether human activity contributes to global warming and urged Southern Baptists to weigh the economic impact of policies designed to reduce greenhouse gases. Then Jonathan Merritt, a student at the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, heard a professor say that destroying God's creation was akin to tearing a page out of the Bible. After consulting with SBC theologians, Merritt drafted a statement calling the denomination's engagement with the environment too timid, and maintaining that our cautious response to these issues in the face of mounting evidence may be seen by the world as uncaring, reckless, and ill-informed. The statement released last March was signed by 45 leading Southern Baptist Convention pastors, including Frank Page. Well, 2007, 2008 were difficult years for the religious right. The death of Jerry Falwell in 2007, followed by that of D. James Kennedy, a televangelist and a mainstay of the religious right, seemed to herald the passing of the founding generation of leaders. And others have since died or retired. In fact, Dobson, a couple of weeks ago, retired as chairman of his organization, Focus on the Family. At the same time, 2007, the Bush administration was foundering. And then there was the embarrassment of the Republican primaries. In the fall of 2007, Dobson, Perkins, Land, and others contemplated a field that included a Mormon from Massachusetts, a thrice-married Catholic from New York, a non-church-going Hollywood actor, a senator who in his 2000 presidential campaign had called Falwell and Robertson agents of intolerance, and a former Southern Baptist pastor. Well, the choice might have seemed clear, but not one of the religious right leaders chose Mike Huckabee. And furthermore, none of them chose the winner, John McCain. They didn't choose Huckabee because they thought he couldn't win, but they didn't get McCain either. Meanwhile, Barack Obama turned out to have charm for young evangelicals, and particularly the most educated ones. The youth pastors in Dr. Hunter's church told me as much. And in a poll conducted by a magazine called Relevant, a magazine for young college-educated evangelicals, readers, when asked who Jesus would vote for, picked Obama over all the candidates then in the race, Republicans and Democrats included. The Obama campaign reached out to moderate evangelicals, Hunter among them, but this past November, 73% of evangelicals voted for McCain, hardly a major realignment from 2004. However, to be noted that votes came overwhelmingly from the South. In the states of the West and the Middle West, 30 to 36% of evangelicals voted for Obama. And young evangelicals, age 18 to 30, in all regions, gave Obama 32% of their votes, or 10 percentage points better than their elders. Well, now come the difficult years for Hunter and the rest of the new evangelical leaders in some ways. They would like to see the culture wars end or at least be diffused, and that is certainly President Obama's aim as well. But now these leaders are going to have to face the fraught issues of abortion, gay rights, and stem cell research. They're going to have to deal with attacks from the religious right, and they don't all agree on all these issues or how to deal with them. The new evangelicals are never going to be the cohesive on-message group that the religious right was. It's not in their nature. Further, the positions within the evangelical community are changing. This point was made quite dramatically in mid-December when the NAE forced Richard Cizik to resign over an answer he gave Terry Gross on her NPR show, Fresh Air. Gross noted that Cizik's views on gay rights had been shifting and asked if he'd changed his mind on gay marriage. Cizik answered, "I'm shifting, I have to admit it. In other words, I would willingly say that I believe in civil unions. I don't officially support redefining marriage from its traditional definition, I don't think." An interesting answer. Well, Cizik was speaking for himself, but as he certainly knew, evangelical views on gay rights have been changing. According to recent polls, 1 in 3 young evangelicals, that is 18 to 30-year-olds, supports gay marriage. And some 60% of them, including that 30%, support civil unions. However, of course, many NAE members objected to Cizik's remarks, and he had to resign because, as Leith Anderson, the president of the NAE, said, he didn't adequately represent the position of the organization. The NAE, Anderson explained, opposes same-sex marriage and, quote, doesn't advocate for civil unions. Another interesting answer. At least since last summer, the Obama team and groups such as the Third Way, composed of evangelicals and secular progressives, have been working to develop compromise positions on abortion, gay rights, and other issues. The proposal that's the furthest along is the one to reduce the number of abortions through such measures as comprehensive sex education, improved access to contraception for low-income women, expanded health care for pregnant women and new families, and the encouragement of adoptions. The proposal has been approved by NARAL and other pro-choice groups. A version of it appeared in the Democratic platform, and now various bills are being introduced into Congress. The religious right will surely fight this legislation, but liberal Catholic groups and evangelicals such as Hunter, David Gushee, Jim Wallace, and Jonathan Merritt support it as a means of breaking the logjam over the issue and doing something positive. But nothing has happened yet in that regard. And in the meantime, the administration has made several decisions related to abortion. It's rescinded the Bush administration's ban on funding for family planning groups abroad that provide or endorse abortions, a so-called Mexico City policy. It's also reversed the order made at midnight in the Bush presidency, giving healthcare professionals the right to refuse services or give information that violates their consciences. This order went far beyond the previous one that permits doctors to refuse to perform abortions if it's against their consciences. Then, too, the administration has lifted President Bush's order limiting stem cell research, and it's nominated Governor Kathleen Sebelius, a pro-choice Catholic, as head of the Department of Health and Human Services. Hunter and Gushee came out for Sebelius because of her efforts to reduce abortions through family services. But the combination of all these initiatives has, in the past week, caused Gushee to protest and to ask where the abortion reduction legislation is. He said he didn't want to be in the position of the religious right simply endorsing everything the administration, Democratic administration, did just because they were doing some other things he liked. I mean, he, in particular, he applauded the statements against torture. Well, back to abortion for a moment. Eventually, one decision or another by the Obama administration is going to expose the fact that moderate evangelicals have a fundamental disagreement on this issue. Some believe that abortion should be made illegal, while others think that abortion can't be ended by government coercion, certainly not when a majority in the country support a woman's right to choose. So this second group, which is anti-abortion as the first, is against overturning Roe v. Wade. Well, there are plenty of other divisive issues out there. For example, the issue of whether faith-based organizations that receive federal funds for secular charity work can discriminate in their hiring practices by hiring people only within their own faith tradition. On this one, I think you'll find all evangelicals lined up against all civil libertarians. So they're going to be multiple divisions, and people are going to be breaking in different ways over different issues. And it's going to be all very interesting to watch. Because evangelicals are changing, and there's not a leader or group of leaders that can claim to speak for the whole community anymore. Thank you. I'd be happy to take some questions, but I wanted to introduce Cal Skaggs, who's there, who's just done a wonderful film on the New Evangelicals, which I hope it was shown in England just recently, and I hope it'll be shown here. A lot of it's about Hunter and others. Not that one, no, on his previous series, which was a while ago on the religious right, and which it was in six parts, was it?
Six hours
of it. Yeah. Yes. Yes, I mean, torture doesn't usually come up in the polls, right? You know, that's usually not polled. But what David Gushee in particular, because he's a major activist on this subject, worried about was simply that evangelicals were kind of not really asking themselves that question and simply going along with the Bush administration. And certainly, you know, he was sort of appalled that religious right leaders never said anything about it. So part of his work was holding conferences, you know, bringing the subject to the surface. Attitudes towards the Iraq War have also shifted, and I think probably evangelicals are the last people to sort of support Bush on this one, I mean, given the major religious groups, but nonetheless, that was shifting as well. And, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens next, because the religious right has always done rather better when its people were out of power. It does better in opposition, because it's, essentially a negative group, and we will see when it starts gearing up to against the Obama administration. But at the moment, their criticism has been rather diffused by the fact that he is black. They really didn't, like to sort of start out by, criticizing the first black president we've ever had. So we haven't heard much from them recently.
Leadership and policy on a very high level. But in terms of our coming recession, depression, and possible turmoil in a lot of different ways in our society as a result, what is the prognosis for that they see themselves for the growth of the evangelical movement?
Which one?
Any of them.
Well, I think that mainly what the recession, if we're calling it that now, is doing is simply moving attention away from all these very divisive issues. And I think that again, the evangelical community is going to be divided over this because Southerners mainly. Really still don't like government intervention, and there's going to be a whole lot of that. At the same time, the young and people in the Rust Belt states and so on, are decidedly for government intervention in the economy and in other areas, and will be for legislation on the environment. So. It's as I say. It's not easy to you can't make one statement about evangelicals anymore. You have to make two or three.
But do people see a growth in the number of people who are going to be drawn to this as a lot of the verities of our society and our capitalism are being challenged, being strained.
Well, I mean, good question, and all I can do is point to the Great Depression, where essentially all those issues that seemed so important beforehand, like prohibition, gambling. I mean, there was anti-Catholicism in the South and elsewhere, simply disappeared for a period of time. Yes. I think Richard Cizik once said to me, that's the third rail. In other words, I'm quite certain, without his ever telling me this, that he is not a creationist, but that he could not say this as president of the NIE. Joel Hunter, however, says evolution is a fact. And that's where these people are going. I mean, it's very hard to talk about human-induced global warming without talking about the kinds of science that are involved in evolution, carbon dating, for one. So, you know, it's a cultural divide, and it's a cultural divide that, you know, I think a lot of people are kind of swimming across without having it really in their face the whole time. I think, you know, the polls keep on showing that creationism is still very important to evangelicals generally. But part of it, I think that they, like many people, can keep two ideas in their mind at the same time. You know, because really what creationism is about is to them the centrality of the Bible. And if you go off and you go into a science class and you talk about microbiology or something, and it's another matter. This happens I was talking about Jerry Falwell's university last time, and that happens there. Yes?
I'm wondering, in your forthcoming book, if you're going to devote any time, chapter, or paragraphs to the whole notion of separation of church and state. Because, you know, I'm old enough to remember the days when it really didn't matter that much what a politician's religion was. It was in the background. And I find it really frightening that whether they're fundamentalists or evangelicals or conservative Catholics, that so much power is being wielded by organizational churches today.
Well, I think that what you're noticing now is the divisiveness of religious approaches to politics. Dwight Eisenhower did nothing but talk about God. He, by the way, he became a Presbyterian, but he came from some very small church before that. But in any case, that was the period in which sort of one nation under God was adopted, and the dollar was, you know, in God we trust. But the thing about Eisenhower, and by the way, Reagan afterwards, who spoke in the same way, they spoke of a non-sectarian God, and often it wasn't even Christian. It was much more of a civil religion. But, you know, if you go back and listen to some of those speeches, you know, Woodrow Wilson, I mean, even Acheson, you know, there's a lot of, you know, religion was so much a part of life generally that it was simply mixed in without anybody really noticing it. But during the 50s, 60s, so forth, the edges of it were shaved off so that it was not a partisan divide. And the partisan part started coming up, you know, with the development of the religious right in the 80s. And so it has continued.
Is it possible to define what evangelical is?
Oh, boy. I thought I spent my whole first lecture trying to do that. But evangelical is kind of a polemical word because it's change definitions over hundreds of years. I mean, it used to mean all Christians, that meant all Protestants, that it meant all pietistic Protestants. And then up the word comes again in 1942, and it seems to say we're everybody except the theological liberals and the separatist fundamentalists. Well, now it includes others, and it includes them because partly people self-identify, partly because pollsters have decided there are certain elements which are important to being an evangelical, like to evangelical beliefs, activism, conversionism, biblicism, crucicentrism is the, and so they go ahead identifying different churches and denominations as being evangelical, even though sometimes those denominations resist the term. For a long time, the Southern Baptist Convention never called itself evangelical. They were just Southern Baptist.
Not too long ago, I was having a chat with someone who was rather vehemently religious, and I was surprised to learn that he was, not surprised to learn he was against gay marriage and the formalization of gay relationships. And then he became, he determined he was against. I asked him why, and he said they've suffered enough. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting the way that gay rights has been moving into more favor in the evangelical community, and it is through the issue of rights. Most people, if they are churchgoers, in that community, will say it's a sin. But okay, they will say it's a sin like other sins. You know, I sin, you know, we're all, you know, sinners. So therefore, we can't separate out people just because of this particular sin. So that, go ahead, yes.
I think it just was that if they married, they'd have suffered a
Oh, sorry.
I have a more somber question. In the New York Times a few weeks ago, there was a letter from, I think, a rather deceptive reader, and he noted that amongst the death rolls published by the Times, people seem to be from small-town USA. ...assiduously for a few years, and I think that's so. And I'm wondering, has anyone investigated, really, the origination of the religion as a group with these young lads who tend to die in their thousands now in Iraq?
In where?
In Iraq, who are dying in the war.
During the war deaths.
Oh. Oh yes. Well, I bet you a lot of them are. I bet you a lot of them are evangelicals. I bet you, because that's, you know, military families. That's where they come from. I'm sure. But by the way, this brings up something which I did want to tell you all, and I haven't done it so far. In case any of you are interested, there is an evangelical megachurch in Manhattan, and you will not see it because it doesn't have a building. Or it has a very small building, but it holds services every Sunday in places like Hunter College. That's its east side location. There's a school on the west side, and there's some place in Chelsea as well, and it's called the Church of the Redeemer. It's Presbyterian, Calvinist. It's filled with sort of what we used to call, we don't anymore, yuppies. but a lot of Asians, because a lot of Koreans are coming into town, a lot of young people. Its pastor has not sort of made a national statements in the way these other people have that I do. But the church is very much into social services in New York City, and also it has groups for artists and writers and that kind of thing. And so, if you're interested, there it is. And there's another one coming up too. I forget what it's called, but they're always popping up. One more question.
Could you mention the
Well, I mean, they are all evangelical, as far as I know, and it just that, you know, as somebody had said, the word evangelical means so many different things, that their paths wouldn't necessarily ever cross with, they'd never find themselves in the Redeemer Church, for example. Well, Calvary is by origin, no? Yeah, well, there you are. I think Calvary is like the Vineyard Churches, which is an association about 650 Vineyard Churches, and both of them come out of the Jesus Movement of the 60s, and they have migrated and become. There are not a lot of hippies and so forth anymore at all. They're very respectable people, but those churches tend to be much more inclined to deal with poverty, with the environment, and so forth than a whole lot of others. Okay, I think that's it. Thanks.